Some interesting Rashi's when Yaakov is in Beersheba. The Torah describes Yaakov, come on in, so Gabby, the Torah describes Yaakov as taking his entire entourage, Ves Ruchushama Sher Rachshu Be'eretz Kanan, and all the money and all the possessions that he acquired in Eretz Yisrael. Well, Yaakov acquired a lot of his wealth outside of Eretz Yisrael. So why does the Torah qualify the wealth that he took with him to Mitzrayim as Sher Rachshu Be'eretz Kanan? So the simple reading is, it's contrasting because he's now about to descend to Mitzrayim. And especially since there was a famine for many years, Torah is telling us that even in Eretz Yisrael, the famine wasn't that severe, and Yaakov's portfolio in Eretz Yisrael didn't really dip. So Asher Rachshu Be'eretz Kanan is not all. This is where he acquired his wealth. Asher Rachshu Be'eretz Kanan just means that the wealth that he acquired didn't decline, even though he lived in Eretz Yisrael during a famine, because Eretz Yisrael was braced from the famine. Just like earlier in Sefer Bereishis, the Torah says Eretz Yisrael was braced from the mumble. So you have two different midrashim, bookending Bereishis, that calamities that strike the earth don't necessarily affect Eretz Yisrael. Rashi gives a very different shot. Rashi says that he didn't want to take with him any of the wealth he acquired in Chutz Laaretz. He said, any money that I acquired in the house of Lavan, I'm not really interested. When did he divest himself of this portfolio? When did he get rid of all of his California investments? So when did he divest himself? When he met Esav back in Vayishlach, he took all the money that he brought with him and all the gold and the silver and the jewelry that he acquired in Lavan's house, and he put it in a big pile and said, Esav, take whatever you want on behalf of your share in Maariv Hamavila. That's what Rashi describes here in Parshas Vayigash about what happens in Vayishlach. And therefore, this connects to the Medrash that when Esav or Esav's grandson comes to contest Yaakov's burial in Parshas Vayechi, son of Tali runs back to Mitzrayim to get all these contracts that have been drawn up in Vayishlach about the sale of Maariv Hamavila. So essentially, the Bechor sale from Yaakov to Esav, or Esav to Yaakov, takes place in three stages. Number one, the lentils. Number two, the brachas of Yitzchak. And number three, purchasing Maariv Hamavila in Vayishlach, as described in Rashi in Vayigash, when Yaakov only took the money to Mitzrayim that he earned in Israel, the Israeli money, the shekels, not the dollars, he takes them down to Mitzrayim, and then in Parshas Vayechi, they have to run back and find the contracts about what happened in Vayishlach. So that's the timeline. So a couple interesting things. First of all, so it turns out that Maariv Hamachpelah, which is not just a burial site, but it's the first Jewish settlement in Israel. This is really the only land that we end up with in the end of Sefer Bereishis. All the other land that we had lived in were hosted by, we live in Beersheba near Avimelech, it's a place of international peace and international harmony. The only place that's solely Jewish in all of Sefer Bereishis is Maariv Hamachpelah. And Maariv Hamachpelah, in the end, is paid with by money from Chutz Laaretz, not from money from Eretz Yisrael. Yaakov pays for Maariv Hamachpelah. There really are two things going on in Yaakov's conversation with Esav. He says, first of all, I don't want this money. It's Schmutz Laaretz money. I don't want it. I just want Israeli money. That's like Rav Shimon bar Yochai, a very famous story. Rav Shimon bar Yochai's Talmidim, one of them went to America, one of them went to Chutz Laaretz, to Spain, made a ton of money, came back. All the Talmidim in the Beis Medrash were really jealous. They said, you know what, maybe we should go for a business trip, make some money. Rav Shimon bar Yochai went out to the mountains, probably Meron, and he caused the mountains magically, supernaturally, they were gushing gold from the mountain. And he said, look, you can make a lot of money here in Israel. Don't worry, but just know that any money you make in this world, you'll lose your share in Olam Haba, which is a dual-layered medrash, both about Israeli money versus non-Israeli money, and about shares in this world versus shares in the next world. So first of all, when Yaakov tells Esav, take what you want, he just wants to divest himself of Chutz Laaretz. And the second part is he uses the Chutz Laaretz money to purchase Maariv Hamachpelah. So everything in Bereishis is setting a pattern. Right, we're living through a stage where in the initial stages of our state of Israel, the state of Israel was supported in large manner by philanthropy. This is the greatest philanthropic project in the history of mankind. How much Jewish money has been steered towards Eretz Yisrael? Billions over the last 70 years. And of course, not just Jewish money, but international money, because this is an international project. We're trying to herald the end of days. So it just makes sense. Like Hiram contributed to the Beis HaMikdash. Like Koresh authorized the second Beis HaMikdash. So this is an international project. It's now the end of the year and the holiday season, America, President's Day. I'll say something very provocative. Who knows if all of American history and the entire Democratic Revolution and Bunker Hill is only so that the Jewish people should return to Israel and redeem humanity. Because again, for us, messianism is not parochial, messianism is universal. So I don't think Americans would be happy to hear that because they have a rich and storied history. Obviously, there are many, many layers to this algorithm. But can you view the last minute? History feels very, very staccato, but you have to read history in 300-year blocks, in 500-year blocks. You can't just read history in 20-year blocks. So this is a pattern that we're starting to see in Parshas Vayigash, where non-Israeli money is used to purchase, whether it's Jewish money, in this case Jewish money is used to purchase. Now, what it also suggests is, and we're living through Geula, slowly but surely Israel's becoming an economic superpower, and slowly but surely Israeli politicians are realizing we may not need international funding anymore. In fact, many people are starting to think about maybe the state of Israel should support Jewish communities financially, not just spiritually. We always saw ourselves as a spiritual support for American communities, but non-Israeli communities. But maybe at some point, the Israeli economy was like ranked third or fourth over the past year. So that's a sign of Geula, that we don't no longer need to pay for Marisa Machpelah with the money from Lavan, effectively. We can pay for Marisa Machpelah, or settle the land of Israel, with internal money. So it's just a fascinating, fascinating Rashi, because everything in Brachos is a story, but it's also an icon. There's a symbol and a pattern behind the story that's set for history. Okay, one other quick Rashi. When the Torah describes Shimon's family, so who are Shimon's children? Nice names. Yimuel, you may want to name your child that. Yimin, if you want your child to be a righty, name him Yimin. Ohad, a lot of people we name him Ohad. Yachin, not so much, but Yachin or Boaz. Those are the parts of the mission. Beis HaMikdash, Tzohar, beautiful name. So he had five sons, Yimuel, Yamin, Ohad, Yachin, and Tzohar. Great names. His sixth son, strange name, Shaul. Very nice name, the first Shaul in Tanakh. You can trick your tricker by leap text and say, who's the first Shaul in Tanakh? But they called him Shaul ben Hakananis. Whoa, where did that come from? Why was he called Shaul ben Hakananis? So this is stripped right from the pages of Ksivos, because who was Shaul ben Hakananis' father? Shem. Or Hamor. This is the product of the rape of Dinah. The Medrash says, and Rashi quotes the Medrash, that Dinah did not want to come back to the family because she was impregnated through the assault on her. And she only agreed to come back if Shimon, her brother, agreed to adopt her. Excuse me, we're saying the mamzer child. This is a mamzer child born out of wedlock to Dinah after her assault that Shimon raised as his own. But to let everyone know, this really wasn't. He wasn't Shaul ben Hakananis. He was Shaul ben Hakanani. He was Shaul ben Dinah. Ben Hakanani. They didn't want to talk about the Kanani. They said Ben Hakananis. They thought maybe Shimon had taken some concubine Kananis woman. So they referred to him as, oh yeah, this was Shimon's Kananis concubine wife that he probably took. But no, no. It was Dinah's son who had been born to Hamor ben Shem. The rape of Dinah. Wow. That's an interesting story. And what do you learn from this story? So everyone is quick to line up and to criticize Shimon because he was militant and violent and is fanatical and fundamentalist. And it's true. We have to check fundamentalism. But fundamentalists and fanatics really care about things and they're very passionate. And he was so passionate about saving his sister that he was willing to take on this bastard child into his family, which wasn't pretty, which wasn't convenient, wasn't diplomatic for Shimon to be walking around with this mumser child. So sometimes before you're quick to criticize people's fanaticism, ask yourself, do you care as much as they care, and can you find ways to express it that are maybe in your mind more healthy and more restrained? But very often we quickly disparage people's fanaticism and fanatical extreme behavior, and it's really just masking our own apathy and our own indifference. We can negate their fanaticism, we can remain in our comfortable zone of a difference. So it's not just Shimon wanted to kill a few people. Shimon really cared about Dinah. And he cared about Dinah so much that he's willing to adopt her mom's or child. Now, his care was so deep and his passion ran so high that he killed the entire town of Shechem, which, of course, we don't validate. Another way of saying this is, passion means you care about something so deeply that you're willing to make self-sacrifice on behalf of those values. Shimon is not just killing people, he's taking great sacrifice to his reputation, to his integrity, to his position within the family. So think about passion and think about what are the things you want to be passionate about and are you willing to make sacrifices in life in order to fulfill your passions? If not, then they're just a lot of lip service. You're saying you care. So I'll end with a story. Rabbi Lamb, Zichrono Livracha, was once sitting with a bunch of board members from Yeshiva University worrying about the state of Chinuch and Rabbanus in America and how our best and brightest aren't entering Chinuch and Rabbanus and how do we solve this issue. So Balaam stopped the conversation and said, raise show of hands, how many people in this room would be happy if their children became rabbis and teachers? And no one raised their hands. So he said, well, I think I would have said the conversation's over. in my brusque Brooklynese term, I would say, if you don't care enough to solve a problem, stop complaining about it. Don't be an armchair complainer. It's very easy to sit in an armchair around the fireside and complain about this and complain about that. If you're not willing to clean things up, then shut your mouth and don't complain about it. That's my Brooklyn way of saying it. Because it's easy just to lodge concerns. So everyone in their life, I made my decision a long time ago that I cared so deeply. Because when I was your age in high school, I didn't really have the rabbanim that I thought I needed. I had because I had rabbanim that didn't really speak to my neshama. I said, this is a problem. I have to be part of the solution, not just part of the complainer. So I'm going to decide to be a Rebbe that hopefully will raise Talmidim, will see in me what I didn't see in my Rebbeim. Whatever, it could be chinuch, could be a lot of other things. But think about passion and sacrificing comfort for passion as a way of life. And you see this in Shimon. It's very easy to line up and to vilify Shimon. But he cares. And he takes Dina's bastard child. Now maybe his care should have been checked at the point of taking a sword and killing Shem. But this is a whole different view of Shem. So two really fascinating Rashis. To read Rashis slowly. Let them, these are not hard Rashis to read. It's not like a Tosas and Ksuvas. So that's the thing. What are the connotations? What's happening? What are the radiant messages of Rashi beyond just the hub of what Rashi says? Okay. Get some breakfast and go to shul. 110, 110?